Coming up this hour, what is the truth about the Crusades and the claims of today's Muslims about them? I'll talk it over with Ibn Warraq, author of Sir Walter Scott's Crusades and Other Fantasies. Portions of the Janet Mefford Show are underwritten by Wellspring Benefits Group. Learn more at controlmycare.com.
The Janet Mefford Show.
Government's first duty is to protect the people, not run their lives.
The key is to stand on the word of God.
We are relevant not because we are like our culture. We are relevant because we are absolutely different.
And I'm not going to apologize for taking a stand.
But if the word of God says it, I believe it.
That's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It is often said in the Muslim world that jihad is the fault of the West, and this all stems back to the Crusades. But is this really true? My next guest takes on the claim in a brand new book. Ibn Warraq is the founder of the Institute for the Secularization of Islamic Society. He's senior editor for the New English Review and the author of great books like Defending the West. And today we're going to be talking about his new book. It's called Sir Walter Scott's Crusades and Other Fantasies. It's wonderful to have you here, Mr. Warraq.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, thank you. This is such an important subject because we do often hear from the Muslim world that had the Crusades not occurred, then we would not have seen jihad. What is the truth, really, about the roots of jihad and how the Crusades do or don't tie into it?
No, the Crusades were forgotten in the Islamic world, and you know, for 400 years. They were only revived, the idea of the Crusades was revived at the end of the 19th century. And in any case, the Christians were responding to several hundred years of jihad. So the jihad preceded the Christian Crusades. The Christians were trying to defend their co-religionists in the Holy Land. They came to the assistance of their Christian brethren in the Byzantine Empire. The Turks had defeated the Byzantine forces, for example, in 1071 at the Battle of Manzikert, and as early as 1074. Pope Gregory had thought of rallying Christian forces to come to the aid of the Byzantine Emperor.
Yeah, right. You're exactly right. And there had been all kinds of atrocities, weren't there? The mass killings and persecutions, not only of Christians, but of Jews before the Crusades.
Oh, indeed, indeed. There was the destruction of the Christian shrines, like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the persecution of the Muslim Al-Hakim, well known. He destroyed churches. He persecuted the Jews. I mean, you have a whole host of atrocities before the first call to the Crusades in 1095. Mm-hmm. For example, the several hundred Jews were massacred long before that. In 1033, 6,000 Jews were massacred in Morocco. Mm-hmm. And then hundreds of Jews were killed between 1010 and 1013 near Cordoba in Muslim Spain, and so on. So these predate the Crusades of 1096 and so on.
So interesting. Well, and isn't it the case, I believe you mentioned, that the Muslim world actually believed that overall they had been the victors of the Crusades?
Yes, yes. When they revived it, it was a way of both giving vent to their victimhood and at the same time trying to paper over the fact that their whole culture and society had been failures in every way, economic, political, and so on. And it kind of eased their conscience. Oh, we're backward because it's all fault of the Crusaders. It is the only way they're able to live with themselves and their moral, intellectual, and economic, you know, failures.
Wow. Well, you know, it's interesting when you say that they just kind of forgot about the Crusades in the Islamic world until the end of the 19th century. What was it that revived their interest in talking about the Crusades at that point in history?
Well, it was of course the encroachment of the West, but one of the events that really triggered all that interest in the Crusades was, of course, the Emperor Joseph. The German Emperor. Went and laid a wreath on the tomb of Saladin, the great Kurdish Muslim leader who defeated the Christians forces at the Battle of Hattin, for example, in 1187. It was then that the Arab intellectuals woke up to the the fact that there had once been a crusade, and that the hero Saladin had been forgotten in the Islamic world.
How interesting. Hang on just a moment. Ibn Warraq, our guest, Sir Walter Scott's Crusades and Other Fantasies. We'll dive more into this new book when we come back on the Janet Mefford Show. Welcome back, 17 past the hour on the Janet Mefford Show. Thanks so much for being with us. Ibn Warraq is joining us. He is the author of Sir Walter Scott's Crusades and Other Fantasies, the book we're talking about, and also senior editor for the web magazine New English Review. Now, we are talking here about the Crusades and how the Muslim world, in fact, Mr. Warraq, came back in the 19th century and began to talk about the Crusades again. And then the narrative became that jihad and the Islamic angst and anger against the West was the West's fault. Now, how in the world did they kind of describe that narrative and push that narrative?
Unfortunately, fueled by Western rhetoric in the late 19th century and early 20th century. For example, when the French invaded Algeria and captured Algeria in early 1830s, they used Crusader rhetoric and said, we're just completing what our Crusader ancestors had started, and they saw it as their mission to civilize the, you know, supposedly barbaric culture. And this continued well into the 20th century, when the various European countries had mandate over the Middle East following the defeat of the Germans in the First World War. They again used Crusader rhetoric. So, in a sense, it was started by the Western imperialists. They justified their imperialism by referring to earlier episodes in Crusader history.
Wow, that is really interesting. Now, of course, in your title, you mentioned Sir Walter Scott, and people will know him for books like Ivanhoe. How was it that Sir Walter Scott portrayed the Crusades in what he wrote?
Well, he wrote a number of books, novels, in which he portrays the Crusaders as the barbarians. The principal one, which he wrote in 1825, The Talisman, quite clearly paints the Crusaders as crude, uncouth, boorish barbarians, and he paints the Muslims as being very cultivated, tolerant, and patient, just defending their homeland. It's quite extraordinary the influence that this novel has had on the whole the mythology of the superiority of Islamic culture and so on. He was, of course, Scott was a Protestant who thought that the medieval crusaders were exemplified Catholic intolerance, Catholic fanaticism, and he had this the Enlightenment contempt for religion in general, really. So and also the he was influenced by various Scottish Enlightenment figures like Robertson, who also painted the Islamic world as being far superior to the Western one.
That is really interesting. So from Sir Walter Scott's portrayal of the Crusades in his novels, how much do you think that fueled the view of the Crusades in America?
I don't know. I wouldn't know how to answer that. You mean in recent years?
Sure.
What influence it had on the writing of history in the United States? I really don't know.
Yeah, I'm just wondering the long-term impact of people who read his novels and enjoyed his novels and in the process picked up this errant view of what the Crusades really were.
Yes, they did have this erroneous view. That is true. He did perpetuate this idea that the Crusaders were out there for really base reasons. They were greedy and avaricious and out to enrich themselves, which is really far from the truth. The idea that a crusader could make money would have been laughable, because in fact they impoverished themselves by going on these crusades. They had to sell their land and property and so on in order to be able to go on these crusades. They were doing this as a penance. They were hoping to shore up treasures in the hereafter, not this side of paradise, certainly.
Boy, that's so fascinating. And you mentioned before, when we were talking earlier about jihad and all the horrors of jihad being perpetrated against Christians and Jews before the Crusades, you know, when you look at the roots of jihad, a lot of people today want to disconnect jihad from any actual words that are in the Quran. But what do you think that people need to understand about the theological roots of jihad in Islam?
Yes, the theory and practice of jihad goes back to the origins of Islam. That's to say, it is there in the Quran, it's there in the biography of the Prophet Muhammad, and it's there in the so-called hadith, which means the traditions, that's to say the deeds and sayings of Muhammad and his companions. It was a very carefully worked out tenet of Islam. It developed by the theologians. It never meant a inner jihad, which is now put forth in an apologetic sort of stance. In fact, it meant jihad in the military sense right from the beginning. It is a duty, it is a religious incumbent duty of all Muslims to spread jihad in every way possible, including the military way. And it's derived from the so-called verses of the sword in the Quran.
Yes, yes. How is it then that we have so many Muslims today saying jihad doesn't mean that, and the majority of Muslims don't engage in Osama bin Laden type jihad, and therefore those are the extremists and the moderate Muslims really represent Islam?
Well, there are a lot of arguments as to if there is such a thing as moderate Islam. I always say that Islam itself is not moderate. They may well be moderate Muslims. That is true, I would say. But the figures are quite frightening, and some of the opinion polls carried out by Pew in Islamic countries, there's a surprising percentage of support for people like bin Laden and the jihadists. But we mustn't be too pessimistic, I suppose. It's difficult to know how reliable opinion polls are. And certainly there are positions which one would call moderate. Not everybody wants to. I think what's playing out in Egypt now is an example of those who don't accept the extremist position, but whether they will win out or not, it remains to be seen.
That's for sure. Now, another thing that you touch on in your book, which I think is really interesting, is the whole South Park episode and how you've seen, and we've seen this with other issues as well, where the West just absolutely folds in front of any Islamic complaint about how Muhammad might be portrayed in a cartoon or in that episode of South Park. But what were your thoughts on that particular episode and the brouhaha that came about after that whole episode was put together?
Yes, I think it was very, very disappointing. It's another example of appeasement in the face of Islamic intimidation, Islamic thuggery. We saw how many people caved in at the time of the Rushdie affair. Yep. The incredible number of intellectuals actually blamed Rushdie for bringing it on himself. It is extraordinary. I mentioned that in passing. But also, the Islamic world, in fact, has been pretty inconsistent. They haven't always condemned representation, including the representation of Muhammad, which is often forgotten until I have no idea what the situation is now in the 21st century in Iran. But Iran produced an incredible number of posters depicting Muhammad, the prophet.
Wow.
And I give examples of some in my last chapter. So, and even the doctrine is not crystal clear. It's full of contradictions, and the Quran is very vague on this issue as well. It's not clear that it's talking about representation. Perhaps what is really intended is idolatry rather than a blanket ban on representation.
Interesting. And I think a lot of Westerners don't really understand why it is you can't portray Muhammad in a certain way, because definitely Christians would say it's not like Jesus, who we believe is God. They don't believe that Muhammad is God. What is the reason that they object so much to portrayals, you know, in visuals of Muhammad the prophet as they understand him?
Well, it's partly this feeling that you might be might descend into idolatry. The other is, of course, the notion that perhaps you are competing with God in creating an image which only God can breathe life into. And so often you would have an image of a person with a line, a clear black line going through the neck, showing that this is only a representation, and that the artist cannot possibly breathe life into it, and only God can do that. So they were afraid that the artist was trying to imitate God's creative function. The only way out of it for some artists was to show that the that Muhammad perhaps only objected to full-size human figures that could be mistaken for real persons.
Interesting. Well, Ibn Warraq, thank you so much for being with us. Sir Walter Scott's Crusades and Other Fantasies. We'll be back. Back 34 past the hour, and we are really excited to welcome our brand new affiliate, Central Florida's top talk station, AM 1390 WFHT in Avon Park, Florida. And if you're just joining us for the first time on that wonderful station, thank you so much for listening today. We hope you will stay tuned, and we want to just welcome in our great new affiliate in Avon Park, Florida. All right, I want to turn our attention to John Stewart, of all people. I know you weren't expecting that, but Kathleen Sebelius, of all people, went on The Daily Show with John Stewart last night. I know, because she's just this huge celebrity, right? And Jon Stewart is dying to interview her because she's just such a fascinating human being. Or could it possibly be that Jon Stewart, as a far-left talk show host, really wants to give a little bit of cheerleader support to Obamacare? I'm with B. At any rate, Kathleen Sebelius didn't really get what she bargained for during this interview. It was a little less than friendly compared to what she was most likely expecting. In fact, Jon Stewart hammered her over problems with the Obamacare launch and the delay for businesses on Obamacare that hasn't been afforded to individuals. I'm going to play a little bit of this audio for you that we've picked up here. Here is Jon Stewart mocking the ineffectiveness of the enrollment process for Obamacare.
We're going to do a challenge. I'm going to try and download every movie ever made. And you're going to try and sign up for Obamacare, and we'll see which happens first.
Okay.
What's going on with this? Is this working? Is this not working?
Well, the great news is we have a terrific market. And for the first time, people are going to have a chance to compare plans, figure out what they qualify for. Insurance companies have to play by new rules.
How many have signed up thus far?
Fully enrolled? I can't tell you because I don't know.
Yeah, dub. Now, I'm going to get into a little bit of the same subject with Jay Carney in just a moment, but I want to finish up this Jon Stewart interview because it's really funny. So Jon Stewart ends up hassling Kathleen Sebelius, the HHS secretary, over the fact that big business gets an Obamacare delay, but of course, individuals, not so much.
If I'm an individual that doesn't want it, it would be hard for me to look at a big business getting a waiver and not having to do it and me having to, because I would think, well, geez, it looks like because I don't have a lobbying group, not that I don't have a lobbying group, believe me, I have a lobbying group. But I would feel like you were favoring big business because they lobbied you to delay it because they didn't want to do it this year, but you're not allowing individuals that same courtesy.
Well, again, big businesses are already in the health market. That's where most
85%
people get...
of people are, yes.
Oh, boy, I got to go to the bathroom, John. Can we go to commercial? Then he continues to press her for answers over the fairness of the delay.
Would you say that's a legitimate criticism, though, that an individual doesn't get to delay it, but a business does? Is that not legitimate?
Because nothing that helps an individual get health insurance has been delayed at all. They'll get the tax credit this year. They have plans to choose from. And the amazing thing is...
Oh, so you're doing it because you haven't been able to get the subsidies ready for the businesses.
Well, the businesses don't get subsidies. They're just going to exchange.
So they get to delay because they're not going to get any extra money. But individuals don't because they will.
Again, they're in the market already.
Let me ask you this. Am I a stupid man?
Blah, 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 blah. One more. Stewart says it's difficult to defend this whole Obamacare thing in light of the way it has been so ineffectively rolled out.
Let me tell you why it may seem that I'm a little hard on this. For those of us who are... somewhat believing that the opposition right now in Washington are crazy people. It is imperative that this government, the government that basically says this federal government has a role to play in people's lives, it feels like it's frustrating to have to defend something that is less than ideal or is functioning at what seems to be a level of incompetence that is larger than what it should be.
You know something? I just think it's incredibly fortuitous that the Associated Press has this headline on a story today, U.S. adults are dumber than the average human. Kind kind of fits in with that interview, doesn't it, John Stewart? Well, I think that the opposition are just a bunch of dopes. I'm paraphrasing. John Stewart, wake up. Wake up. The people who are fighting on Capitol Hill to not defund this monstrosity that you have been smart enough to notice can't be rolled out effectively are not the dopes here. They're not the dopes here. They understand how bad this is going to be, and this is just the beginning. And you might want to rethink who your political heroes are, John Stewart. I know that you're a zillionaire, and it's not going to affect you very much, but it sure is going to impact the middle class like crazy. People are already beginning to tweet all about this. They have a Daily Caller headline from some of these tweets online today. I like you, Obama, but I'm broke. Americans upset that Obamacare costs money. Well, what in the world did you think this was going to be? Some kind of heyday on a carnival circuit? Woo! Let's just have nonstop cotton candy and go for a ride on that tilt-a-whirl, and everything's going to be fun under Obamacare because President Obama said. I'll have more to say. We'll come back. I'm looking through some of these tweets about Obamacare, and as I was mentioning before, it's just, I don't think that it's a coincidence that today the AP is reporting U.S. adults are dumber than the average human. It's long been known that America's school kids haven't measured well compared with international peers. Now adults don't either. In math, reading, and problem solving using technology, American adults scored below the international average on a global test, according to results that were released today. Adults in Japan, Canada, Australia, Finland, and multiple other countries scored significantly higher than the U.S. in all three areas on the test. Beyond basic reading and math, respondents were tested on activities such as calculating mileage reimbursement due to a salesman, sorting email, and comparing food expiration dates on grocery store tags. Not only did Americans score poorly compared to many international competitors, the findings reinforce just how large the gap is between the nation's high and low skilled workers and how hard it is to move ahead when your parents haven't. Well, super. And I'm sure Common Core will just make it all better. All better. Eric Owens, and I really am going to get back to Obamacare, but since I mentioned Common Core, I want to mention this. This is from, again, the Daily Caller. Eric Owens, well, America, if you thought the people behind Common Core couldn't possibly be any, in his words, moronic or tone deaf, you were wrong. A Common Core worksheet handed out this year in a sixth grade history class in Bryant, Arkansas, required students to ditch two amendments from the Bill of Rights. If you were to get rid of your liberty, which two sections of your liberty would you like to be jettisoned? Students were also told to plug their rights eliminations by creating a visual aid that could act as a clear representation of your proposal. Incredible. The assignment is part of the Common Core State Standards Initiative, an attempt by Educrats to standardize various K-12 curricula across the country. And as we know, 45 states and the District of Columbia have begun to implement the curriculum. The assignment's instructions, which include hideous grammatical errors such as the use of the plural pronouns they and their to refer to the singular noun government, tell students that the government of the United States is currently revisiting the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Really, are we now? We're having a constitutional convention? Awesome. I want to go. I want to go to a constitutional convention. I've never been to one. I wasn't aware that we were having some sort of great national discussion about throwing out the Bill of Rights, other than what we've witnessed from the Obama administration. At any rate, back to the Obamacare tweets. There are some here they're listing. One says, paying a penalty for not having insurance, so we're being punished for being healthy. Obama, not care. Somebody else says, just notice that I will be paying more for my existing health insurance come December. Thank you, Obamacare. How about this? I was all for the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, up until my son's insurance premiums almost doubled and became anything but affordable. Those are questions that I think would have been good to pose to Kathleen Sebelius by Jon Stewart on The Daily Show last night. He could have really knocked it out of the park, but his liberalism stopped him. What a shame. Now, Let's go to Jay Carney because he's always a reliable, well, source of comedy. They have over at Paterico's Pontifications. Jay Carney will not tell you what the Obamacare enrollment has been. Now, when I played that clip of Jon Stewart with Kathleen Sebelius a few minutes ago, you heard him ask Kathleen Sebelius, so how many people have actually enrolled in Obamacare? I'm only the head of the HHS. I don't know. Come on, John. I don't want to talk about that. So they have loved telling us, though, how many people went to the websites. How many people have been to the websites? Oh, it's just enormously popular for people to go to these exchange sites and look all around at the glories of Obamacare. But how many people have they been able to enroll? Well, let's see. Can we go back to talking about how many people have actually looked at the websites?
In the first 72 hours, healthcare.gov had over 8.6 million unique visitors. As you know, there were seven times more users on the Marketplace website first morning than have ever been on the Medicare.gov site at one time.
But you still don't know how many people have signed up?
I'm glad you asked that question because I want to be clear about it. When it comes to enrollment data, you know, I want to clear this up. We will release data on regular monthly intervals, just like was done in Massachusetts and just like what was done and is done when it comes to Medicare Part D.
In other words, I don't know. I have no idea. Or in other words, far too few for me to actually tell you. I love that. Whenever Jay Carney is pushed into a corner, it becomes, well, let me be clear about that, which is exactly what his boss loves to tell us all the time. Let me be clear. Let me be clear that I'm not telling you. So why not? Well, ABC's Jonathan Carl asks the obvious question. What is the problem here, Jay Carney? Why won't you tell us how many people have actually enrolled?
You can give us numbers of traffic, how many people go to the website, but not how many people.
Again, this is large volume. There's no question that there's large volume, and these are rough estimates about the volume. One of the reasons why we've been able to, why we've provided the information about the volume is because it is the principal reason why we've had slowdowns and other issues that we've had to try to resolve to make the consumer experience better.
It is the bureaucratic way of saying squirrel, isn't it? Look over there. Look over there. There's something really interesting, very bright and shiny in the corner. You might want to look over there, Jonathan Carl, because I don't have any numbers for you. I'm not going to tell you that. Accountability? Yeah. That is so 1952. Okay, so Paterico over at his website is talking about this issue of how many have actually enrolled in Obamacare, and he points out that the state of Maryland has actually released its data. Do you know how many people in the state of Maryland have enrolled in Obamacare? 326 people. The state of Maryland says it has thousands of people interested in buying health insurance on its new state-run exchange, and that's how many people have signed up. So he asks, is it fair to extrapolate Maryland's numbers to the country as a whole? After all, Maryland's site has been plagued with technical problems, but so has the federal site. So maybe it is fair. Let's look at the numbers and see. Well, census.gov is down due to the government slowdown, of course. But Google tells us that Maryland has a population of almost 6 million people. And the U.S. population is 314 million people. They have had 170,000 visitors to the Maryland site. And only 326 people actually enrolled. So he says, by my math, if Maryland has 326, that's about parallel to 17,000 people signing up in the federal exchanges nationwide. So fewer than 20,000 enrollees in Obamacare so far in the entire country. And if that is true or close to being true, no wonder Jay Carney is yelling squirrel. Metaphorically speaking. We'll be back. Stay with us. You're listening to The Janet Mefford Show. Tell you what, they really have their priorities straight on the left. Did you know that despite what they have done to the World War II veterans, a planned immigration reform rally will take place today on the National Mall, even though the site is closed? Oh, okay. Organizers for this March for Immigration Reform were spotted setting up a stage, the Washington Examiner reports, and also equipment on the National Mall for the rally. A few scattered barriers around the park have signs informing visitors that the area is closed as a result of the government shutdown. They talked to Susanna Flores, a spokesperson for the rally, and said that the Park Service will allow the event to take place under the group's rights granted by the First Amendment. Oh, they're so nice to the amnesty lovers. You know, kick those veterans to the curb. Arrest them. Throw those guys out. But, you know, let the amnesty lovers in. It's just disgusting. I'm sorry, if you even were a Democrat who voted for Obama, at what point do you finally look at this and go, this is disgusting? Here's something else they're doing. CNS is reporting this. The Clinical Center at the National Institutes of Health has suspended its dog therapy program because of the government shutdown. Yeah, that's got to be expensive. The spokesman for the NIH said the dogs, which pay visits to patients in the hospital, include children with cancer. You know, the ones that Harry Reid cares so much about that he says, why would I want to help a kid with cancer? Right. These dogs have to be seen by vets, and a team on staff made the decision to suspend the program because a vet needs to evaluate the dog. And given that there's a 25% reduction in staff, we focus our activities and staffing on the care of patients already at our hospital, this guy says. I'm sorry, but do you not have dogs who have already been cleared by a vet who are in existence, who maybe, oh, I don't know, 9 days ago were cleared to go visit kids in the hospital, who could potentially be brought in as dogs that were already cleared and they're perfectly safe. And the vet said those dogs were healthy and maybe they'd like to cheer children up in a hospital by seeing those dogs. There is no effort on the part of this administration to do the right thing, to look classy, to look at all compassionate. It's just deplorable. Let's find the most painful area we possibly can to kick people to the curb and blame it on Boehner. And they're trying, but even some poll numbers are showing more people are actually not falling for that than are falling for that. Yeah, you can't have your dog, little kid. And by the way, Harry Reid says, if you get sick, I'm sorry, but I can't fund you. Boy, nice. Nice, nice, nice. Also, going to throw this in, that Republicans, speaking of Harry Reid, are pressuring him to allow a vote on that resolution that will urge the military to let chaplains freely minister during the government shutdown. Remember all of that chaos over the priests and allowing priests to actually be chaplains and have services? Then they had to pass that bill. People's true colors are coming out, aren't they? Well, we've got to go, but we appreciate your listening today. We hope you will visit us over at janetmefford.com, and we'll see you there.